We're in the gospel of, one more thing, a question during break. Just to make it clear why I say that I think the boy is part of the entourage. I think it's clear that the food is expected to come from within the disciples' community in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And then the way the boy is described in John, which gives us the idea of the cutesy little boy with the bread and so forth in the front row, is extremely vague. And if you knew Greek, I'd be happy to show it to you. It doesn't say, here is a boy, or this is a boy, or this is the boy. It just says, boy here has food. That's all it says. Now, that may sound odd to you, but it is actually... A boy is here. He has food. But even the word isn't there. Boy here has food might almost be a translation of it. And so it doesn't specify, so Matthew, Mark, and Luke do, and that's why I take it as I did. Well, the disciples in Matthew chapter 14 are perhaps Jesus' hope. Not so strong was their performance in 14, wanting to get rid of the crowds, but maybe they're going to get things a little bit. And in fact, the counterpart of opposition and the crowds not understanding anything is that the disciples do seem to understand things at least a little bit in chapter 14, verse 22 and following. After the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus withdraws for a time of prayer. And he sends his disciples on across the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is about 17 miles long, and at its widest point, 8 miles wide. It says, if they traverse the widest possible part, good rowers, men who know how to get around the Sea of Galilee, after all they were fishermen, could do it in a couple hours. But it says in the fourth watch of the night, they were still tortured by the wind. And Jesus came to them on the wind, on the water, through the wind. They're terrified. They think it's a ghost, verse 26. But Jesus says, take courage, it is I, don't be afraid. Peter says, Lord, if it's you, let me come down to you on the water. We talked about this in our first night together. Let me just remind you. This is a perfect picture of the disciples at this phase. Enough faith to get out of the boat. Not enough faith, well, let's put it this way. Not enough faith to get out of the boat. Enough faith to walk on the water to Jesus. Not enough faith to stay up. Enough faith to go, not enough to endure, we might say. Jesus says this to Peter. You of little faith, why did you doubt? Why did you hesitate? Why were you between the two, faith and unfaith? So there we have it. That's the scenario. Strong opposition, the crowds understanding nothing, the disciples understanding, having a little bit of faith, just a little bit of hope, a little promise that maybe they're learning a few things. The cycle continues in the very next account, and that is found in chapter 15, verses 1 to 20. I want to do it very briefly and simply say to you, here's another controversy with the Pharisees. A controversy, in this case, over why Jesus and his disciples don't eat. Jesus says they're concerned about all the wrong things. They're people who honor me with their lips. They have the traditions of men, but their hearts are far from me. It's not what's on your hands that makes you clean or unclean. It's what's in your heart. The Pharisees are opposing Jesus. Next, we have the story of the Syrophoenician woman, which we've studied already, and then I will jump to the feeding of the 4,000, verse 29 of chapter 15. Here again, we have great crowds coming to Jesus to be healed, and they are healed, and they're amazed, and they're praising God, which is a little bit better. Jesus said, verse 32, I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. I do not want to send them away hungry, or they may collapse on the way. The disciples answered, but where can we get enough bread in this remote place to feed such a crowd? Answer? Hey, just 40 verses ago. Now, you know, in the actual event of Jesus' life, it may have been weeks. We don't really know how long the time frame is between chapter and chapter. But as we read the story, and in fact, if they'd really taken in the story, they would know the answer to their question. Calvin said this about it. He said, "All who have once or twice experienced the power of God and distrust it for the future are convicted of unbelief. For faith cherishes in the heart the remembrance of the gifts of God." That's for little quotes like that that we like John Calvin, or maybe better, we respect him deeply. And he gets right at the cusp of the matter, doesn't he? If they really appreciated what God had done, even if it had been a month or 2 months, they would know the answer as to where it would come from. But nonetheless, Jesus does go ahead, despite their lack of perception. He goes ahead, he takes care of things, and then feeds the people. And immediately after that, chapter 16, verses 1 to 4, back to the Pharisees and their opposition. The Pharisees and Sadducees come to Jesus and ask him for a sign from heaven. What's wrong here? He just fed 4,000. He just fed 5,000. He's healed people who are demon-possessed. In chapter 14, verse 30, we barely mention it, but it says he had healed the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. What is it exactly that they want? And besides that, Jesus is not in the business of performing enough miracles to force faith. And so he says, he's not going to do it. It is rather only a wicked and adulterous generation that looks for a miraculous sign. The only sign they're going to get is the sign of Jonah. That is the sign of the prophet who himself was, for all appearances, dead and then came to life again. That will be your sign. Jesus goes across the boat again and warns his disciples. Verse 6, "Be on guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." And that's all he says. And his disciples discuss that among themselves a little bit, and they come to the conclusion, he's upset because we don't have any bread. Now, this is when you really start to get discouraged. Because, see, lack of bread is not a problem. That is not the problem. Problem is lack of understanding, lack of insight, lack of discernment. Certainly, the Pharisees and Sadducees have that problem. Jesus says to them again, verse 8, "You have little faith. What are you talking about?" I'm not talking about bread. You know that I can create all the bread that's necessary. You have to be on guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Now, what did he just do there? He said the exact same thing he said earlier. He said, you have to beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And they completely misunderstood. He said, no. You have to beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. When you say the same thing to somebody twice, and the first time they don't understand it, you say it again, what are you doing? You're implying that if they just listen, they can understand this. He doesn't go around and explain it at length. He says, listen to me. I'm just going to say it again. And then they get it. They understand. That's what he says. Then they understood, verse 12. He was not talking about bread. He was talking about teaching. So slowly, the disciples are coming to understanding. It is possible. Which leads us to the next passage, and that is the confession of Peter. Verse 13 of chapter 16 says that Jesus took his disciples, they're doing a lot of traveling these days, to Caesarea Philippi, pretty far up in the north. Ask the question, who do people say the Son of Man is? And I asked you to read this passage carefully in your English for today, and maybe to meditate on it, or write a reflection paper on it, or whatever the case may be. Did you write a reflection paper? No, you didn't. It was last year. You've got another one for tonight. That's right. Who do people say the Son of Man is? Now, what do you notice about their responses here? They say John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. What is the common thread, or what are the common threads in these answers? Okay, they're prophets. Anything else? Well, they're all dead is another one. They're all Old Testament except for John the Baptist, and he is actually in the Old Covenant regime. Anything else? They're all persecuted. Good. And there's one more good thing to be noticed. They're all kind of softball sorts of answers, or positive kinds of answers. So this isn't all they were saying about Jesus, you know. They were saying some things a lot worse than this. So they're trying to be nice. They're saying, these are the nice kinds of things they're saying about you. And I suppose that for you and me, if somebody said, hey, you know, what do you think of Katrina? And said, well, you know, I think she's a lot like Jeremiah and John the Baptist. I'd imagine that Katrina would feel pretty good about herself, maybe embarrassed a little bit, but maybe pretty good about it. Jesus is not satisfied. He says, and again, the Greek shows this a little more carefully than most of the English. Jesus says, but you, who do you say that I am? He says it twice. But you, who do you say that I am? Who do you say the Son of Man is? And the answer is, from Simon Peter, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, that's quite an answer. It's an excellent answer. And Jesus says so. You're blessed by God. God revealed this to you. And for a couple reasons. For one thing, he got something right. Christ, that Jesus is the one anointed to do God's work among God's people. But then he added something crucial that not everyone in that time understood. And that is that Jesus is also the Son of God. See, many people thought that the Christ, most people thought that the Christ would be a Davidic figure, a great king, a great leader, a military conqueror, one who would eradicate the influence, the hegemony of the Roman Empire over Palestine, over Israel. And so they expected a human figure. It's also true to some extent that any figure who would have the capacity to drive out the Romans would be considered to be blessed with the spark of the divine, some touch of the divine essence that would empower him to do that. So for him to say the Christ, the Son of God, is a very good answer. Probably a fair number of people could have even agreed in some vague sense that he would be a special person, maybe called Son of God. But Peter was actually, I think, confessing even better than that. Better than that. And also better than he knew. It goes on to say, you're blessed, and I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not overcome it. Now I have to ask, are there any present Roman Catholics in this class right now? Any present? Any former Roman Catholics? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, something like that. 10 maybe. What does the Roman Catholic Church say about this? Marianne.
He was building the church on Peter, and that's why Peter's Peter
okay.
Church.
Okay, that was a lot in a hurry. Peter was the first pope. Church is built on Peter, and that's why the Roman Catholic Church is the true church, because it has the succession from Peter, who can pass things down. And that is how the Catholic Church understands this. What can we say? What does this passage mean? Is Jesus really making Peter the rock of the church, the foundation of the church? Well, let me just hold that question a little bit, because we'll get to an answer by just continuing to read. We'll see what Jesus intends by this passage. Before we continue, let me just suggest this much. if indeed Peter is the rock on which the church will be built, then the church is on a pretty rickety foundation, isn't it? Pretty soft. Furthermore, we know that from elsewhere in the Bible that Jesus is the sure rock and foundation. Anyone who builds his house in the sand, anyone who builds on the rock, chapter 7, Jesus of Matthew, Jesus is the rock. The prophets and the apostles build on him. And Jesus himself says this in chapter 21, 42 of Matthew. He says that he is the stone which the builders rejected. He is the keystone. Actually, the stone terminology changes just a little bit from foundation stone to keystone or capstone. But the idea is if there's one stone or one rock on which the church is built, it's Christ. And once he lays the foundation, then the apostles and the prophets build on that. That's from Paul, Ephesians chapter 2 and 1 Corinthians chapter 3. He goes on to say, and we'll say more about Peter in just a little bit. He goes on to say that the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Now, how have you always heard this interpreted? Always heard that what this means is that no matter how much Satan attacks, the church will never be destroyed, right? Can you just pause for a minute and think about something? What are gates? What do gates do in warfare? They keep people out or in. They're protection. They close the city off. So if the gates of hell will not prevail, what might that mean? Craig? If the gates of hell will not prevail, what that means is that the church is on the offensive. And that those gates of hell will not be able to hold off the advance of God's kingdom. Now, I know that on various occasions I tell you, you've always heard it one way and it's probably another. Let me be very candid with you here. That's one view, and I wish I could tell you that I knew for sure. The truth is, it is possible that the gates of hell and there's some references in the period, in the literature of the period. The gates of hell means the powers of hell, because gates would be strong. And so the powers of hell won't prevail. So what I'm going to tell you is, next time you think what this is promising is the church won't be destroyed, you know, it's at least possible that what he's saying is, no, the advance of the church can't be stopped. Don't think negative thoughts. Don't think we'll hold out somehow. Think we're going to advance. And even if it's not in this passage, and again, I'll tell you candidly, it's almost a 50-50 as to which one it is. Even if it's not in this passage, we know from Matthew 13 and other parts of the Bible that the gospel is going to grow like a seed and have a mighty harvest. And it is going to be preached to the ends of the world. We know not to think defensive, insular, fortress kinds of thoughts. God's kingdom, God's church is advancing. Yes.
Another reason why I think that makes more sense is the fact that he says that I will build.
Yes, that's right.
So that's another thing that would make.
That's a good point.
The church going forward.
That's right. The comment is, I will build. I will build my church. This is about advance, not about holding off attacks. Yes. Sorry, I've lost it. What verse are we in? Oh, sure. The question is, how do we know what the referent of the word it is? On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not overcome or overwhelm it. How do we know that it is the church? Answer is basically garden variety rule for pronouns. You always pick the nearest antecedent unless you have overwhelming reasons not to. So the nearest, didn't mean to do a play on words there, the nearest antecedent to it is church. Therefore, we say what's not going to be overwhelmed is the church. The next passage continues to give us insight into the nature of the claim and the work, we might say, of God and the nature of the church. It is this, that from that time on, I'm going to skip a little bit actually because we'll get to it later, but in verse 21 it says, from that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers, be killed, and be raised on the third day. So Jesus is saying, this is the nature of my church. You confess that I'm the Christ, the Son of God, but I'm going to tell you what kind of a Christ I am. I'm not a mighty conquering stallion riding Christ. I'm a suffering and dying Christ. That's who I am. And when Peter hears that, he says, no way. That can't happen. And now you see that it was true when I said that Peter didn't quite understand what he was saying. Because he said, you're the Christ, you're the Son of God. And then he said, yes, and I'm going to the cross. And then he said, right, I know you're the Christ, I know you're the Son of God, but I need to straighten you out on a few things. You're not going to the cross. Now see, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Because it just doesn't register to say, I know you're God, but I need to correct you on a few things. So Peter doesn't really understand his confession. In fact, he has to grow into understanding of his confession, even as we all have to grow into a lot of things. I'd like to maybe put it to you this way. Peter understood what he was saying when he said, you're the Christ, the Son of God, about the way you understood the words, I love you, the first time you said them to somebody of the opposite gender, not your mom or dad. Now, the first time you said, I love you, to some, if you're a male, pretty young thing, or, you know, cute fellow, if you're a female, I don't know, I don't want to get into that too much. Cute fellow, I don't know how to say it, I don't talk about that. Anyway, let's just stick with the men, shall we? The first time we men, and ladies, you just make the necessary changes. The first time we said to a girl, I love you. What did we really comprehend of that? What we probably understood was something like, I feel a strong attraction to you. I feel good when you are near. I feel all ushy inside. You know, I've got a strange feeling in the pit of my stomach when you walk by. But, you know, if it was the one, or whenever the one came and you said, I love you, you did grow, maybe still are growing, into understanding what that means. It takes time. We can be hard on Peter, and there is something to be hard on here. He is doing a foolish thing twice over. One, telling Jesus not to go to the cross and proving to be Jesus' adversary. Get behind me, Satan, he says. And second, it shows that he hasn't comprehended. If Jesus is the Son of God, then I guess he knows better than Peter knows. Peter hears this then. Get behind me, Satan, Peter. You are a stumbling block to me because you don't have in mind the things of God, but the things of men. And now we know in what sense Peter is or is not the rock of the church. Because the word that's used there, stumbling block or stumbling stone, is another word for a rock. So when Peter confesses you are the Christ, the Son of God, then he is the rock on which the church is built. The word, by the way, is Petros, a little play on words in the Greek. Jesus says, Petros, you are Peter Petros, and on this rock, Petra, I will build my church. Maybe to make it clear that Peter himself isn't the rock, he changes the word just a little bit. But then when Peter makes a bad confession, when Peter says something false, when Peter says something to Jesus that Satan would have him say, when he has his mind on the things of men, human ideas like conquest and victory and painlessness and glory, then he is stumbling stone, Peter. And the idea is one I suppose we all know. You know, you're walking along some beautiful river and you're trying to spot a yellow-bellied sapsucker and you're looking up in the trees and, you know, you're trying to see it and all of a sudden, you know, you step on a stone, you go sprawling on the path. That's what he's talking about. You are a cause for stumbling. So, in what sense is Peter the rock in which the church is built? When Peter is making a good confession, then he is foundational to the church. When Peter makes a bad confession, then he is not at all the foundation. It's not Peter per se, the man. It's Peter as he confesses Christ. That's the sense in which he's foundational. And that's the sense in which all the apostles are foundational. The proclamation of Christ by those 12 witnesses is the foundation of the church. And I will say, even to this day, the foundation of the church remains not men, but confessing men. Men who say, Jesus is the Christ. Men who testify to him and to his work. That's the foundation, not a man. Let me just pause for a question or comment if anybody has one right there. Right. Peter's, I think I'm going to take the point this way. Peter's failure to comprehend is predictable. He saw Jesus' humanity day by day, and now he has to learn something new. It's not as though we're free of problems. We can undercut the reality of the humanity of Christ in all kinds of ways. We think of him as our Lord. He is. He's also a real man. And for example, one of the constant questions came up a little bit in this class. What about the temptation of Christ? You know, was he really tempted? We almost sometimes can hardly believe that he was actually tempted. He actually was enticed by some things. Well, it's because we don't take his humanity seriously. Cliff, was that your hand? The question is, how can the Catholics say that Peter was the first pope when he makes such big mistakes? And you know, the answer to that is probably a little bit complicated, but one of the things is they say it's only when the pope speaks ex cathedra. So that if you ask the pope if it's raining outside, and 20 minutes ago it was not, and now it is, but he hasn't looked outside, and he says it, you know, whichever one, however I put it, it's not raining, but it is, that doesn't undermine his infallibility because he's just talking as a man. And it's only when he speaks from the chair that he is infallible. So they would actually say popes can make lots of mistakes, but not when they're speaking as the vicar of the church. And listen, the Catholics aren't fools. They would have all kinds of answers to this. But you know, our purpose is not to answer the Catholics, but to see what's actually being said. The main thing is, it's not Peter, it's the apostles as a group in their confession and teaching that's central. Okay, good questions. Yeah, one more. Boy, I'm not sure. What does it mean that he calls him the living God? I would just say it's a confession that, you know, God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not was. You know, he's still the God who lives today. Right. Well, let's take a look at what happens next. After Jesus predicts his death, he then makes a statement that is vital to our understanding of discipleship. And it is this: if you want to be my disciple, not only do you have to stop thinking the things of men, but you actually have to, Peter and all disciples, you have to take up your cross and deny yourself and follow me. My life is a pattern for yours. I'm not just talking about me. I'm talking about the way of discipleship, the way of belief. And here, we move from the realm of theology, who am I, and what's the right theology of the Christ, to the matter of personal commitment. See, once you discern, you have to commit. Once you see what the issues are, you have to resolve how you'll respond. Let me use an analogy with you. Suppose you're by a lake, and there is a boat out there, about 200 yards out, and it capsizes. And there are two people on the boat. One is a teenager, one is a little child. And you can see when the boat capsizes that the teenager is not a great swimmer, but good enough, pretty sure, good enough to make it to the side. Not good enough to rescue the child. The child is floundering. You're not a great swimmer, but you can swim. Maybe you even took some life-saving classes 25 years ago. Or 10 years ago, or whatever the case may be. Once you see the child is drowning, mere discernment is not enough. You've got to commit. If the child drowns and somebody comes by and says, what happened? You know, how did the child... And you say, you know, I could see it happening. I knew what was going to happen. I analyzed the situation very rapidly. I knew that child was going to drown. That's absolutely worthless. If you see, if you discern, you must commit. Swim yourself, get a boat, get a piece of wood, get a rope. I don't care. If you discern, you've got to act. And that is what Jesus says next. It's theology. It's the life of the church. It's also your life. You have to be willing to take up your cross and follow me. Now, that's a hard teaching. And so Jesus gives, especially to his inner disciples, some encouragement and some enlightenment, we might say. And that comes in the scene that we call the Transfiguration. I want to go through the Transfiguration very briefly and just pick out the main point. The main point is, or really there are two main points, that Jesus really is divine. When he is transformed before them, when his clothes become as white as light, when his face shines like the sun, they see Christ in his resurrection glory. Well, not even that, in his eternal glory. They see him in his deity. They see him the way he appears in the book of Revelation, so that when people see him, they instantly fall before him in terror if they don't believe, in joy and adoration if they do believe. This is Christ in his nature unveiled. And they get to see it. He is the Christ. And then the voice from heaven which says, "This is my son." You're right, Peter. I love him. I'm well pleased with him. Listen to him. And that's the second great point. He's going to tell you hard things. He's telling you about the way of his crucifixion, about the fact that you're going to have to follow that. Listen. Listen. Hear what he has to say. The rest of Matthew chapter 17 carries us through some of these implications a little bit. It shows in the parable, in the miracle of the boy with a demon being healed, that it doesn't take a lot of faith, just a little. And that another episode that shows that Jesus is indeed the Christ, the Son of God. And then we come to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. I don't know if you feel it this way or not, but you know, we're just kind of picking up speed a little bit as we go through things. It's by design a little bit, because one of the things you want to do when you read the Gospels is realize that it's good to slow down and study one 5-verse cluster for 2 or 3 or 4 hours sometimes. But you know, that's a really strange way to read, isn't it? I mean, if you were reading the Gospels for the first time and somebody gave it to you, how long do you think it would take you to read the Gospel of Matthew? Let me put it to you this way. If you read a chapter a day, how long does it take you to read the Gospel of Matthew? 28 days. If you're a real person, you read a chapter a day. It's a chapter every day you read. So how long would it take you? Don't ask is the answer. 3 months, 4 months, I don't know. Maybe you only read 6 or 7 verses or 10 verses at a time. You meditate on things. It could easily take you months to read the Gospel of Matthew. But if you were reading it the way you read an ordinary book for the first time, how long would it take you? A couple hours? 4 hours? 2 hours? 3 hours? 4 hours? A couple days, right? And we lose something when we read just 5, 10, 15 verses at a time. We lose the sense of urgency, the sense of forward progress. In fact, I would even like to urge you to try something that I've tried, and in fact I've done several times, and that is, sometime you're on a trip, get the Bible on tape and just throw the Gospel of Matthew or Mark or Luke or John in and listen to it from beginning to end without stopping once. Now, it'll drive you crazy because you'll want to stop and you want to hit the button all the time. Because you want to think about it and say, what does that mean? Why did he say that? Oh, that was good. But it will also be enlightening because you'll see how fast things move. You'll see how a question that comes up in chapter 4 is answered in chapter 10. And it's not a month later. It's 18 minutes later. Or 40 minutes later. See? And there's a sense of rapid momentum, hurtling almost toward the cross. Jesus, from that time on, 16:21 said, began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law. He must be killed and raised to life. He said it in 16:21. He said almost the exact same thing with a little more detail in chapter 20. He said it again in chapter 21, and by chapter 22, it was looming. From chapter 16 on of Matthew, the gospel is constantly warning us about Jerusalem. In Luke, it's chapter 9. It says in 9:52 of Luke, he set his face resolutely or like flint for Jerusalem. He would not be deterred, even though he knew that every prophet must die in Jerusalem, chapter 13, 33 of Luke. The Gospels are moving toward their climax, and they really can't be understood apart from that climax. Therefore, sometime, read it fast. And we've been doing that just a little bit for the last few minutes. But there are also values in reading slowly, and we are going to slow down a little bit in just a minute. And I'd like to stop, really, and slow down and look at Matthew 18 in the structure of Matthew just for a minute. You remember that there are five blocks of teaching material in the Gospel of Matthew? Remember that? First one is? Five big Sermon on the Mount is number one. Number two. You're allowed to cheat and look at your Bibles if you want to. The mission discourse in chapter 10. Number three, teaching on the kingdom, the parables of Matthew 13. And here's number four. You can tell they're blocks of teaching material because each time it says something like, when Jesus had finished saying all these things, dot, dot, dot. Okay? Now, these five blocks are unique to Matthew, not all the teaching being unique, but having them these big blocks of teaching. It's scattered elsewhere throughout Mark, Luke, and John. And we might say they seem to slow things down, maybe, and stop that narrative hurtling toward Jerusalem, but it's also true that they all come at just the right time. In Matthew chapter 5, 6 and 7, Sermon on the Mount, describing the life of discipleship, what did we just get in chapter 4? Great crowds are following Jesus. See? And so, here's you crowds what you need to know if you're going to follow me. And then, the mission discourse followed chapters 8 and 9, which describe Jesus' conduct of his mission. So, 8 and 9 show how he does his mission. And then 10, he says to the disciples, now you go do it this way too. You go do what I've been doing. And he sets them out and they do it. The third block, the teaching in the parables, came at just the right time. We needed to hear about the parables of the kingdom because we had just heard about all the opposition, right? Chapters 11 and 12, how difficult, how much opposition there was. Now, chapter 18 describes the life of the church, and it comes at just the right time. It's about community relations, and we do need it, and we need it just precisely here. It starts in 18:1 with the disciples asking Jesus a question. Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus answers, you know, this question unnerves me. The very fact that you're asking about who's the greatest makes me question your insight. Because the truth is, you have to become like children or you will never even enter the kingdom. That is, don't worry about greatness. Worry about the question, are you even in? So the first mark of the community is humility, humbling yourself like a child. The second mark of the community, I'm going rapidly again, is the way you treat children. To be great, you have to welcome a child, number one. You have to teach a child, teach them well, teach them carefully, don't lead them astray, verses 5 to 10. Be careful that you don't despise them, verse 10, because God doesn't. God sets a high store on him. Verses 11 to 14, you should seek the lost. And so throughout we get in this section, we see that Jesus is saying, in my community, the issue is not greatness. The issue is how do you treat the little ones? If you want to ask about greatness, here's the question. How do you treat the little ones? How do you treat the insignificant ones? How do you treat the lost ones? Do you take care to teach them well and honor them in your kingdom? Humility. The second thing that Jesus says is, things are going to go wrong in my church, in our community. And when they do, I want to give you a plan. Now, you've read, I think I asked you to read and to reflect on Matthew 18, 15 and following for tonight. So let me just ask you to see what you find. What do you do if your brother sins against you? What are the steps you're supposed to take? What's the plan of Jesus? Let me ask, does anybody who's never yet spoken once in this class think they have the answer to this? And you know who you are if you've never said a word. Okay, here we go.
You go right to that person.
Okay. Okay, number one, you go. And that means you don't give them a silent treatment and hope they can figure out why you're not talking to them. Right? So the first thing is, go. Didn't say sulk, withdraw, and gossip. He said go. You would think he'd said that. We would be very obedient if he said that. But he said go. The second thing he said was, show him his fault. That's right. And the word there, show fault, is kind of a word from logic or demonstration or proof. Demonstrate, prove his fault. In other words, don't just share your feelings. I feel bad about what you did. Well, that's interesting. Is it because you were feeling bad, or did I actually do something wrong? If somebody did something wrong, I'm not advocating an accusatorial tone, but I'm saying if they did something wrong, show them what they did. All right, those are the first two elements. Somebody else who hasn't spoken a single time in our class, what's next? Yes. Okay, if he listens, you can win him back. I'm going to put that as number four. The goal is to win your brothers. One more thing that's specified. All right, I'll let anybody say it now. Yes, Keith. Okay, it's got to be between the two of you. And you understand why, don't you? If you rebuke somebody publicly, what's going to happen? They're going to be defensive. They're going to try to take care of their honor. But if it's between the two, maybe there'll be a little conversation. The reason I did that is because of this, or... there was some complicating circumstance, or you're right, can you help me overcome it, forgive me, and give me a plan. These are the three things you do, and the goal is to win. Everything you do has a goal of winning your brother. Now, when we look at this passage, oftentimes we think of it as one that teaches about church discipline, about how to kick people out of the church and things like that. This is a positive, constructive passage. The purpose is to win and to bring reconciliation within the body. It does say a little bit later that there are some steps that you can take. If they don't listen, take two or three witnesses, and if they don't listen even to them, you put them out of the church. You treat them as an outsider. And then Jesus says this, I tell you the truth, whatever you bind on earth, most translations say, will be bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Now, I really don't mean this class to be a sort of an infomercial for the value of studying Greek. I just can't help myself. So here goes. The Greek literally reads, whatever you bind will have been bound. And whatever you loose will have been loosed. Now, do you see the difference? Past tense, it's already been done. Now, what a Catholic, to bring back Peter and the Catholic Church in this, a Catholic, classic Catholic theology says, see, this demonstrates, now, by the way, I said classic. I'm not saying every Catholic you meet is going to say this, but classical Catholic theology, which existed in the Middle Ages and so forth, and exists sometimes today, is going to say, see, this demonstrates the power of the Pope and the priests to release and to forgive sins. And what they say is what happens. But what you need to do is get back into the culture of the day. And you need to realize what the key words here mean. To bind means to forbid entry. To loose means to permit entry. These were idioms. To bind means to forbid entry. To loose means to permit entry. And what you're doing when you engage in church discipline, when somebody says, I'm not going to listen, I'm not going to heed, I'm not going to pay attention to what you're saying about my sin, they're saying, I don't really care about holiness. I don't really care about the life of discipleship. I'm going to live as I please. And then you bind that person. You say, if you are persistent, if you're persistently impenitent with regard to a sin, then you're not in the kingdom. I'm not saying you're saved by works or you have to be perfect to be in. But a Christian does not persist in deliberate sin when it's been demonstrated to them. And if you say, I want to keep on doing this, what you're saying is, I'm not a disciple. And all you're doing in church discipline is saying, if you really mean that, if you really mean you're not going to change and you want to continue in sin, then I can't call you a disciple. Because God doesn't. That's been bound. The person who says, I refuse. I'm not talking about the person who has an accidental sin they can't overcome. They're sorry about their sin. They have a besetting sin, whatever language. I'm talking about the person who deliberately persists. Says, I refuse to repent. I refuse to try to change. That person cannot be a disciple. And they're bound. They're excluded from the kingdom. And if that person says, I'm sorry, please forgive me, then, of course, you're in the kingdom. What it's saying is that when we describe the work of God and what it means to be a disciple, when we say, if you refuse to believe and you refuse to heed and you refuse to be a disciple, and you, if you say, listen, with that attitude, you're excluded from the kingdom. You're not going to dwell with God forever. All you're doing and everything you're doing is to proclaim God's standards. This is the way of God. And when you say to a person, if you're sorry for your sin, you take that sorrow to God, then you are in. You are permitted into the kingdom. All you're doing is proclaiming what God has already proclaimed. And that's our responsibility. Not to make people in or out, but to declare, again, what God has already determined, what God has already said. That is church discipline. That is true teaching, and that's fundamental to the life of the church. The next two verses are two of the most widely quoted and, I'll say, partially abused in the entire Bible. And of course, you know how it goes. If any two of you agree about anything on earth, it'll be done for you by my Father in heaven. And that, of course, is the verse people use to say, let's agree together right now. Let's, you know, seize this promise and pray together that God will give each of us a new Lexus by November 30th. And the two of us have agreed, and so here we are in agreement, and we're praying, and God will do this thing for us because of verse 19. And see this other verse, see, two or three of us have come together, and we've even prayed in Jesus' name, and therefore we're going to get our Lexus. I actually have a friend from an earlier phase of my life. I haven't seen him for a long time. Who, you know, said, we prayed that God would give us an apartment for half of its normal value. We got together and we prayed, and, you know, sure enough, we got it. And I'm going to do it that way from now on. See, that's not what this is about. I'm not opposed to people gathering and praying together. I'm all for that. But that's not what these verses are about. These verses are saying, when you are in the process of proclaiming kingdom life, when you are rebuking sin, especially when you have to come to the point in the agony of church discipline when someone is refusing to heed, when you are taking anything, and one more time, the Greek word is pragmatos, but it doesn't mean any request. It doesn't mean any prayer request. It means any matter. And the Greek word has a legal overtone to it. When you take any case to God, when you take one of these cases of church discipline or sin in the body of Christ, when you take that to God and you ask for help in that case, He will grant. And if two or three of you are just are in agony over trying to restore somebody who strayed from God, God promises, I will be there with you. I will guard you as you guard my gospel. I will protect and encourage you as you redeclare my standards to the world. That's what those verses are about. I'm not saying you can't pray in groups of two or three. I'm not saying it's wrong to pray, you know, and ask together for things. But that's not really what these verses are about. These verses are really about the purity and the preservation of the church and the true gospel. We need to take a break, and I'll take a couple questions about that right after we take a break.